invest in our communities and add more police to communities so that they feel occupied. That's unacceptable. It's been going on far too long. It's a manifestation of institutional racism through police brutality. And that's why we call for truth and reconciliation, massive financial investment, and massive focus on mental health, social workers, and public health overall.
And Jamal Bowman, I wanted to ask you about the forces arrayed against you on the side of Elliot Engels from, of course, Hillary Clinton, making one of her first endorsements on a congressional race this year for Elliot Engels, as well as a major political action committee that receives a lot of Republican money, and a major lobbying group, a pro-Israel lobbying group, all behind Engels on top of the Bronx Democratic, the infamous Bronx Democratic machine.
I mean, that's fine. I mean, that is what it is. That's not what we can control. I think what it shows the public and the country is that we've been running an incredibly strong campaign. You know, we have an amazing team. We have an amazing campaign manager, comms director. I mean, we've been running a strong campaign, and we're just focused on doing our job and connecting as much with the voters throughout the district as possible. You know, we've canvassed the entire district from the very beginning, building strong, authentic relationships from Scarsdale to Rye to Co-op City to Edenwald to Yonkers and everywhere in between. And, you know, we're 6 days away from
you're,
you know,
tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, coronavirus cases in Portland have decreased slightly after record highs. Portland City Council has passed the city budget, a move that includes a small decrease in the police budget. And in national news, President Donald Trump continues to defend law enforcement actions across the nation. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 17th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. On Wednesday, health officials in Oregon reported 122 new cases of COVID-19 and a slight decrease from days before, including yesterday's record high of 278 new cases of the virus. The Oregon Health Authority also reported one death from COVID-19. The state's death toll is now 183 people. Yesterday's record case count has been largely attributed to an outbreak at the Lighthouse United Pentecostal Church in Union County of Eastern Oregon. Union County has voluntarily returned to Phase 1 of Governor Kate Brown's coronavirus reopening plan. The county had just moved into Phase 2 on June 5th. Multnomah County is scheduled to move into Phase 1 of the plan on June 19th, this Friday, which will require masks to be worn in all indoor public spaces. Oregon has reported at least 100 daily new coronavirus cases in 8 of the last 10 days. Prior to this, the state had only one reported 100 case day on April 4th. Health officials say the surge in cases is due to numerous potential factors, including the partial reopening of the state, workplace outbreaks, and increased testing and contact tracing. To date, Oregon has had 6,218 cases of the coronavirus. Nationally, at least 2.1 million people have tested positive for the virus. At least 117,000 people with the virus have died in the United States. Worldwide, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 8 million people. At least 445,000 people have died. Demonstrations continued last night in Portland, with thousands marching across the Fremont Bridge and onto southbound Interstate 405 in support of Black Lives Matter. The march against police brutality and systemic racism began at Jefferson High School around 8 p.m. and was organized by Rose City Justice. Organizers called on the Portland City Council to vote down a proposed plan for the Portland Police Bureau's budget that falls far short of the $50 million in cuts called for by much of the city. A group of protesters gathered at the Justice Center in downtown Portland, where, according to Portland police, a flag cord from a nearby flagpole, as well as a U-lock, a popular locking device used to secure bicycles, were used to lock the doors of the Justice Center from the outside. Shortly after 1 a.m., a driver hit three demonstrators near Southwest 3rd Avenue and Alder Street. The driver was identified as 27-year-old Anthony Eagle Horse Lissandro and was arrested on charges of felony hit-and-run, reckless driving, and possession of a controlled substance. Three people suffered non-life-threatening injuries. So far, no other arrests have been made. Portland City Council approved the city's budget earlier today, including a 3% cut to the Portland Police Bureau. With more on the story, we go to KBOO's Nat Moon.
Portland City Council approved a $5.6 billion annual city budget on Wednesday morning, which included a 3% decrease to the Portland Police Bureau's budget. This is the first time the police budget has been decreased in years. The Portland Mercury reports that the $15 million in cuts will dissolve three police units that have a history of racial discrimination. Those are the Gun Violence Reduction Team, the School Resource Officer Program, and the Transit Police Program. The budget will also slash eight jobs, or the equivalent of $1 million, from the Bureau's Special Emergency Reaction Team. Despite all the cuts, the Portland Police Bureau's budget is over $229 million. Many Portlanders are disappointed and outraged by the decision to cut the PPB's budget by a mere 3% instead of the $50 million demanded by organizations and individuals at a public hearing on June 10th and 11th. Nearly 750 people signed up to give testimony last week, advocating for the $50 million cut from a recommendation put forth by Portland African American Leadership Forum and Unite Oregon. Many Portlanders called for a complete defunding of the police. Commissioner Chloe Udaly gave the only dissenting vote on Wednesday, but the budget still passed. Lisa Bates, an urban studies professor at Portland State University and one of the founding members of the Portland African American Leadership Forum, said of the commissioners, quote, "None of them are meeting this moment. None of them are hearing or responding to the call to defund, to dismantle." She went on to say, quote, "This is just incremental reform. We're not interested in that." The budget will go into effect on July 1st. Reporting for KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill abruptly resigned today, 6 months before his term is set to expire. He asked Governor Kate Brown to allow DA-elect Mike Schmidt to finish the rest of Underhill's term. Underhill has worked in the district attorney's office for 32 years and has been Multnomah County DA since 2013. In an email to staff, Underhill wrote that though he welcomes the challenge of this moment of, quote, "monumental and lasting societal change," he believes it would be unfair to the community to ask DA-elect Mike Schmidt to begin the process anew, and potentially differently, in January. The announcement came as a surprise to Schmidt, who currently serves as the director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission and ran in the race for district attorney against Ethan Knight, winning with 79% of the vote. Underhill's last day in office will be July 31st. Gresham Mayor Shane Bemis announced yesterday he would resign, joining the city manager and police chief, who both have resigned in the last week. Bemis, who runs a restaurant in downtown Gresham, explained he was leaving the office he'd held for 14 years because of business and family demands linked to the COVID-19 pandemic. The resignations follow a June 8th internal letter written to city leadership by Corey Falls, Gresham's deputy city manager, alleging subtle racism and a lack of support for employees of color. Falls wrote, quote, "It was very clear to me that those in leadership were not going to accept or support a black man in a leadership position." Gresham City Manager Eric Kvarsten announced his retirement on June 8th, and Police Chief Robin Sells announced her retirement on June 11th. In April, as workers in meat processing plants around the country fell ill with coronavirus, threatening plant closures, industry leaders, citing the threats of catastrophic food shortage, appealed to the government to allow them to remain open. President Donald Trump ordered it so. The shortage, which led some grocery chains to limit meat purchases, didn't actually exist. Numbers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture show that the industry exported 129,000 tons of pork to China in April, a record amount. Because of the coronavirus abroad, China actually was suffering a shortage of meat. Ben Lilliston, co-executive director of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, said industry claims about shortages were aimed at ensuring liability protections and avoidance of local regulations contained in Trump's executive order, even as the industry continued to ship its product overseas. Not long ago, the federal government passed a bill that gave small businesses around the country aid to survive the economic impacts of the coronavirus pandemic, commonly known as PPP loans. In a move for more transparency, groups around the country, including in Arizona, are demanding the Trump administration clarify exactly where that money is going. Mark Richardson has that story.
The federal government is spending billions of dollars to help small businesses in Arizona and elsewhere survive the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. But in an unprecedented move, the Trump administration is refusing to say just where all that money is going. Congress is considering legislation to force Treasury officials to reveal which companies are receiving forgivable loans under the Paycheck Protection Program. R.J. Cross with the Arizona Public Interest Research Group says keeping that information secret is outrageous and illegal.
None of that info is going to get made public, and even just the names of companies and businesses getting these loans is now to be considered proprietary information, which, to be clear, is pretty ridiculous. We are talking about over $500 billion.
Cross says during the Great Recession, federal bailout programs named businesses and the amounts they received, allowing investigators to more easily see where taxpayer money might be misused. But Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin claims releasing that information now would be anti-competitive. Cross says Arizona PIRG believes keeping the information secret raises some troubling questions.
How are we going to know if the program achieved its end? How are we going to know that those billions were spent in the best possible way during a global crisis? And how are we going to know that that program doesn't end up as a vehicle for corruption?
Cross says watchdog groups have already uncovered instances of huge loans going to large, well-funded companies instead of benefiting small businesses and their workers.
Transparency has always been a bipartisan issue. No one wants to see taxpayer dollars get wasted on inefficient or corrupt spending. The biggest bailout in U.S. history deserves the most transparency, and nothing could be clearer than that.
House Democrats are backing a pair of bills that would require the Small Business Administration to make the loan recipients and amounts public. In addition, public interest groups and news organizations are suing the government to release the information. For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
Yesterday, President Donald Trump said the public, quote, wants law and order, whether they know it or not. Trump gave a speech from the White House Rose Garden in which he defended U.S. police and attacked racial justice demonstrators prior to signing an executive order approving some law enforcement reforms. Trump also said, quote, there will be no more looting or arson, and the penalty will be very grave for those who get caught, referring to the minority of protesters committing property damage. The measure does little to meet what civil rights activists and demonstrators have been demanding since George Floyd's murder on May 25th. Kristen Clark, who's the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, said Trump's executive order, quote, sugarcoats the grave national crisis of police violence and fails to acknowledge that racism and systemic discrimination have led to the deaths of unarmed black people at alarming rates. Trump said on Tuesday, quote, Americans know the truth. Without police, there is chaos. Without law, there is anarchy. And without safety, there is catastrophe. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made a move on Tuesday that could require House members to wear a mask during committee hearings. Mask wearing had until this point been, quote, highly recommended, and many House members adhered to the recommendation. Some Republican members refused to wear masks or only wore them occasionally. South Carolina Republican Tom Rice announced this week that he had tested positive for the virus after being asked a few weeks ago why he didn't wear a mask around the Capitol. New guidelines issued on Tuesday by the attending physician of Congress, Dr. Brian Monahan, will now require a mask for anyone meeting in a, quote, limited enclosed space, such as a committee hearing room, for greater than 15 minutes. Pelosi has directed committee chairs to require masks at committee meetings starting on Wednesday, and authorized the sergeant-at-arms to enforce the rule by barring entry to anyone refusing to cover their face. Members who refuse to cover their faces will be allowed to participate in hearings remotely. Meanwhile, the White House will no longer require West Wing employees to wear masks. House spokesperson Kayleigh McEnany said on Wednesday that the policy had changed to recommending masks, not requiring them. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Max Rameau of Reclaim the Land and Pan-African Community Action on community control of the police. At 5:45, stay tuned for News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, we'll hear Rural Roots Rising. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 52. Tomorrow's will also be cloudy with a high of 81. Today in history, in 1871, writer and civil rights activist James Weldon Johnson was born. Johnson served as executive secretary of the NAACP for 10 years and wrote prolifically during what is known as the Harlem Renaissance. He was the first African-American professor to be hired at NYU and later worked at Fisk University. The quote of the day is from a poem called The Young Warrior by James Weldon Johnson. It reads, quote, "Pray, mother of mine, that I always keep my heart and purpose strong, my sword unsullied and ready to leap, unsheathed against the wrong." Native leaders in Canada say policing in Canada needs reform too. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canada's top Native leader says systemic racism needs to change. He was commenting on policing in Canada. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
Perry Bellegarde is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. Bellegarde says it's time for political and police leaders to go beyond the question of whether there is systemic racism within their institutions. He says it's time to make reforms, not just talk about them. Bellegarde says the discussion now should be about how to make those changes. He adds that excessive use of force is there within the police, and it's time to fix it. Last week, senior members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police gave conflicting statements about racism within the force. A week later, they confirmed that racism is systemic throughout the ranks. Bellegarde says the changes must come at the top.
These police forces, these men and women, are sworn to uphold and serve and protect all people, including First Nations people. It's hard to, how do you trust people when you see that video, that violent takedown of Chief Allen Adam? How do you trust? It's very difficult. And so we need to start working together as soon as possible to fix a system that's broken. And systemic racism needs systemic change, and it starts from the very, very top.
Bellegarde was referring to RCMP dashcam video of an incident in which an officer appears to be punching and tackling Chief Adam after he was confronted by officers in Fort McMurray, Alberta. The incident was over an expired license plate tag. Since then, there was another confrontation in Nunavut, and two Indigenous people were killed by police in New Brunswick in separate incidents. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A Native chef helped organize deliveries to elders amid COVID-19 in the Minneapolis area, but with the recent protests, that had to be stopped for a couple of weeks. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
With the stay-at-home orders in place in Minneapolis, many Native elders relied on Brian Yazzie, Navajo, to get daily fresh meals. But then with the death of George Floyd and riots that took place, that daily meal had to stop for 2 weeks.
So we end up switching our daily meals to serving grocery bags twice a week. So we have detergent, we have bar soap, you know, we have shampoo, hygiene products, we have face masks, and then non-perishable items like canned beans, canned vegetables, and some frozen meat that we also put into the grocery bags.
Vanessa Casillas, Ho-Chunk, and a volunteer, said her previous job experience helped figure out when they couldn't do daily meals and shifted to grocery distributions.
My background is actually in construction, so I'm used to working on a job site. I'm used to things always changing, and you have to adapt and flow with it. So this really isn't too far out of, I mean, yes, I've never lived through a pandemic before, and I would say no riots either. So those two things, really, we just had to become fluid and adapt.
Head chef of the Minneapolis American Indian Center, Ben Shendo, James Cochiti, talked about how their role is mainly to get food to elders who may not see anyone during the day.
But we know during that lunchtime, when they open the box, they got something that can, you know, really bring them joy. And some of the stuff that you can see has been donated, also has been going with them. You know, crossword puzzle, hygiene kits, you know, coloring, just stuff to kind of keep the morale up. And some of these elders who came to the center and the others that were feeding, some of them are living by themselves. You know, some of them don't have, you know, too much interaction. Maybe coming here to the center was it. So that also makes me think about, you know, that extra love, extra care.
The daily meals that go out, as Yazzie explained, are 50% indigenous items to provide comfort food for those Native elders. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael remembers that conspiring together means breathing together.
Remember when saying it took my breath away meant a positive, exciting experience? Now, if a policeman takes your breath away, you could die. When coronavirus ravages your lungs and a respirator may or may not be available or enough, 50,000 gallons of leaked oil in British Columbia smothers a lot of soil and wildlife. While Trump removes restrictions on air and other pollution, pollution which tends to be sourced where poorer people live and work, let's clear the air, open all the windows, and let the sunshine in. All across this country, records are being set for the most consecutive days of protests, the most cities protesting, and this is just the beginning. Decades of systemic injustice won't be solved quickly. Those benefiting from that injustice won't surrender without sustained pressure. So take a deep breath. Get out in the streets if you're able. Support, donate, write, organize, volunteer. So much has to be changed. There's something for everyone to do. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Even though the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic tended to hit Democratic-leaning metro areas, over time, more GOP-heavy areas are seeing increasing numbers of cases. One of those areas is Tulsa, Oklahoma, where President Donald Trump has a rally on Saturday. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Even though the beginning of this virus tended to hit very Democratic places, New York City in particular, the whole metro area of New York, over time, now in June, we see predominantly Republican areas being hit.
Demographer William Fry of the Brookings Institute says 274 new counties achieved high COVID status in the last 2 weeks, 100 cases per 100,000 people. Of those counties, over 9 out of 10, or 253, voted for President Donald Trump in the last presidential election. Fry says many Americans take cues from their elected officials, and the president and some leaders politicized the virus from the get-go.
Some of the governors and mayors are now saying, well, maybe we opened up a little too early, and that may come back to haunt those officials, and especially the president, in election time. People feel that they weren't warned clearly enough about where the virus is coming.
Including Tulsa, Oklahoma, where many businesses have reopened. President Donald Trump plans a big rally on Saturday, despite pleas from city officials to either cancel the event or move it outdoors. It's scheduled in an indoor arena for 20,000 people. Here's Democrat Abby Broyles, who's running against Oklahoma Senator Jim Inhofe, in a very windy setting.
Here in Oklahoma, we have worked so hard to keep people safe and healthy throughout the pandemic. These are the precautions health officials are still taking to keep people safe. The rally this weekend will undo all of that.
The city's Republican mayor, G.T. Bynum, has yet to join calls to postpone or cancel, but also hasn't touted the event like some of his fellow Republican Oklahomans. In neighboring Texas, also facing increasing coronavirus rates, the Democratic Party is still working to expand absentee voting to everyone. They're asking the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in. The latest court decision sided with the state GOP that absentee ballots are only for voters who have a disability, are 65 and up, or currently out of state. Gilberto Hinojosa chairs Texas Democrats.
We are not restricting your right to show up to a polling place. What we're saying is that a Texan who wants to exercise this constitutional right to vote should have a right to do it by mail. That's it.
Yesterday, President Trump signed an executive order incentivizing police reforms with discretionary grants from the Justice Department. It does not address qualified immunity, and local police departments are only eligible if they follow his directions exactly, directions which appear to leave some loopholes and might be different from local and state practices. It drew criticism from activists and others interested in police reform. UCLA professor Joanna Schwartz, a leading expert on police misconduct, says it's critical to end qualified immunity and create more oversight.
No matter what shape public safety takes in the future, there will continue to be government officials that have tremendous power over our lives. And we need to think about what our systems are for keeping those people accountable to us.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 17th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Mark Richardson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Willamette on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's KBOO Talk Radio. At 9, we'll hear Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with host Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, catch Fight the Empire, connecting world history with current events. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11:30, it's Radio Zine. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined today by Max Rameau, a Haitian-born Pan-African theorist, campaign strategist, organizer, one of the founders of Take Back the Land, author also of the book Take Back the Land, talking about the liberation of land and reclaiming. Thank you so much for being with us today, Max.
Thank you.
Now, you have recently written, along with Natfa Freeman, Community Control versus Defunding the Police, a critical analysis. Right now, the call, abolish the police, has quickly turned into defund the police. And as activists are pushing local districts to do that, including here in Portland, there is some question about whether that kind of gradual incremental decrease in funding will actually lead to the systemic change that people are hoping to achieve. I think you addressed that some in your article, and I wonder if we can start by talking about how defunding may not necessarily lead to abolition.
Yeah, so I think that right now the social function, really not just now, but the social function of police is to protect property and really wealth, to protect money and to maintain the social order that allows a small number of people to hoard huge amounts of money. That's really the social function of the police. I think the theory behind the defund movement, which I think, by the way, is incredibly visionary, that people are trying to imagine a society without this force there, and I think it's an important development in terms of the way social transformation happens. But I think the theory behind that is that police are right now funded by public dollars. If they're defunded, then that force dissolves and is abolished in that sense. However, if those who now have money are intent on keeping their money, then it just means, I think, that they're going to replace this public force with their own private security force. And we've seen this in places all around the world, but even in modern Western societies like South Africa and even in growing parts of the United States, we see these private security forces that are not ostensibly enforcing the law, the public good law, but they are enforcing whatever their employers want them to do. I think that is the likely outcome of defunding, is a proliferation and explosion in private security forces.
Do you see another way forward? Could it be combining the defunding of police with the mass taxation of the wealthiest, say at a 90% rate, in order to create a redistribution of wealth?
So that could, in theory, redistribute some wealth, but that's not all that we're trying to do. The biggest problem, particularly for Black communities and oppressed communities, is that it wouldn't change the fundamental power relationship between our communities and the police. And that's what we actually need change, is the power relationship. And my organization, Pan-African Community Action, we take the position that Black communities in the United States are a domestic colony in the U.S., and the police behave like a occupying army in our communities. Well, even if we were to take some money away from the police and tax the wealthy, that wouldn't change that relationship with the police. Even if we were to increase taxes on the wealthy and defund police, it doesn't mean that George Floyd would not have been murdered the way that he was, because his relationship to the police would still have been exactly the same as it is right now, even if there would have been fewer police, and even if some of the ultra-wealthy would have some of their money taken from taxation. So what we really want to change is the fundamental power relationship between police and our communities, not just the amount of money that the police have or the amount of money that wealthy have, even though we do want to change those things as well.
And maybe you can explain how that works. You've been developing the Pan-African Community Action following the murder of Alonzo Smith by Washington, D.C. Special Police in 2015. What does that movement look like, and what does it envision as far as a shift in power dynamics?
So what we're proposing is that the overarching demand or objective for this time should be community control over police. We should have community control, local communities who should have direct control over their police. If you think about democratic bodies in this society, the least democratic structure in this society is the one where its members get to carry guns and arrest the members of the general public. That's the least democratic part of this society, institution in this society, the governmental institution. We think that this is the institution that should be the most democratic, and therefore we should have these local community boards that then control the local police. So what we're proposing is a ballot initiatives throughout the country, where cities would be divided into policing districts, and those districts can overlap significantly or even exactly. Wards or commission districts or council districts, whatever you call them, in your city. And then each district gets to vote on its own whether they want to keep their existing police force or whether they want a community-controlled force. And what I imagine is that some districts inside of a city would say, we like our police force, we want to keep them, great, to keep them. And then other districts would say, we think the police act like an occupying army, we don't want them here, we want our own force that we control. And those communities should have the right to do that. So just like single-member districts, whatever someone votes for in District 1 has no impact on what someone votes for in District 5, and some communities would get their own police run by an entirely civilian board comprised of individuals who live in that community.
Well, that sounds really different from what is being talked about as community control of the police here in Portland and in other places, which is the Citizen Review Committee that comes in and makes recommendations based on complaints about the existing police force. How can that, what we have and what people perceive of as community control of the police, be transformed into what you're talking about? You said ballot initiatives, but I think part of it is also just the impression of what does community control of the police actually mean?
Yeah, and I think in this society, we don't really have a very well-developed concept of what power actually is. Reviewing the power of someone else is not having power. It's having the ability to review, and I don't want to review what the people who I pay to walk around with guns in my neighborhood do. I want to be able to tell them what to do, and if they don't do it, then I want to stop giving them my money. And that would then be power. So what we don't want review over the police. We want power over the police. When the elected officials in the city, the council members or the alderpersons sit and they make decisions about the budget, they don't review what happens with the budget. They actually vote, and their vote means something as to what happens to the budget. We want the same thing to be collectivized, the same power to be collectivized in our neighborhoods, where we have power and control over the police. Not the ability to review whatever it is that they do. We need to be able to hire them. We need to be able to fire them. We need to tell them what their priorities are and tell them what the policies are. And if they follow those and they get a paycheck, and if they don't, then we find someone else.
And what would such a police force look like? Would it be armed and militarized like the one now that we see all across the country?
So this is the great thing about it. Because it's community controlled, then each community would get to make that decision for themselves. And as we have done in Washington, D.C., where Pan-African Community Action is based, when we've done these visioning projects with members of our community, we bring them in and we say, what does public safety look like to you? Very few people mention guns. So what we imagine and what we've actually workshopped out is that if we had a force that we controlled, the majority of the members of that force would not carry guns, because that doesn't impress members of our community. It bothers some members of our community, and most of the interactions that happen don't require them. So most of them wouldn't have guns. They would have cars, or they would be able to pick people up, picking up elderly people who are waiting on a bus during the winter. Apparently, is a very big safety issue for members of our community, and all kinds of other things. The other thing that would look different, I think, is right now the priorities of the police in downtown areas is that if there's a person who's homeless and has nowhere to go to the bathroom and then attempts to urinate on a building, the priority or the job of the police is to protect the building from the human urine. And when we've had these workshops with members of our community, they say, we want an intervention at that point, but we want to protect the person. We need to figure out why that person doesn't have a place to stay, why that person doesn't have a place to go to the bathroom. So if these decisions were centered in our community, the way that would look different is that what we now call police would intervene when a person who's experiencing homelessness was using the bathroom outside, but they would intervene in order to help the homeless person. They would not intervene in order to help the building. And so that's why I would say that when we have community control and the communities are able to reimagine what safety looks like for them, we might have to rename the institution, because it would look so wildly different than it does now. It probably would make sense to call that force police.
I was just thinking about that, given the history of police and what they've meant to Black and brown communities in the U.S., just calling them police, I think, may be part of the problem if they have actually a different function in what you're envisioning.
Right. Certainly in terms of the different function, for us, the name is not the biggest problem, although the name invokes the history. But the real, switching the name without switching the function, in other words, if we change the name but we didn't change the power relationship between our communities and the police, would also not be acceptable. We don't want the Flower Brigade, who still controls and contains and hunts down and beats and kills people in our community. Mm.
Well, and right now, a lot of city councils, including here in Portland, are having these discussions. We had hundreds of people testify to call for cutting funding to the police in the last couple of days in the budget hearing in our city. And I wonder, I know a lot of people would agree that what we need is something different, is a different idea and a different approach to public safety, but can't really transform that into what we have in the city government right now, into a demand. Right now, the main call is to cut funding by $50 million. What would be your recommendation to the people who really do want to see a transformation of this institution but don't really know what to ask for or how to do it in the city government?
We should be demanding power and control. We should be demanding power over and control over police departments. To me, in some ways, their budget is irrelevant. The real question is who controls what they do with that money? If we controlled them and they did things that we liked and did things that we supported and did things that we said we wanted done in our communities, no one would be asking to cut their budget. We'd be asking to improve their budgets. The real problem is that we don't control them and they're doing things that we don't want them to do. And so the natural reaction, this is a normal and very healthy reaction, to say, well, we want to cut funding for them. But a ideological and political reaction is to say, we want control over that entity so we change their function in society, we change their behavior because they're responsible to us. We should be fighting for power, not for incremental or even significant budget shifts, which doesn't address the underlying question of the relationship between police and most people in this society. Because for most people in this society, the job of the police is to protect those who are wealthy, to protect the wealth of those who are wealthy and those wealthy people, and most people in this society are not wealthy. We need to change the underlying power dynamics, not the marginal tax rate, not the annual budget.
And are there examples of what you're talking about anywhere in the world?
There are. There are in informal ways, anywhere where you see where there's not a police state, where there is not a fully functional, fully formed, and fully funded police department. People get together and they form their own ways of dealing with harm. And they they figure out ways of dealing with their own security issues, as well as with their own collective safety. And so, anywhere where you see an underfunded or completely unfunded police department, you see some form of community control. And because that form of community control doesn't always take the shape of a uniform police department, then we tend to think of it as different. But that really is then what things look like when there's no police who are defending wealth, and instead there are people who are just trying to figure out how to live healthy, happy, and safe lives.
So then maybe at a local level, defunding the police could be considered a first step towards community control.
I think that only the limitation there, I think the imagination of thinking about a local area with no police is extremely important. But the practical reality is that if you were to entirely defund the police in Portland, it'd be no time at all before Walmart brings its own private security firm in. And it'd be no time at all before some of the wealthier enclaves in or mainly around Portland would then put up these gates and walls and be patrolled by private security forces. And we would have less control. We'd have be able to have less influence over those departments than we do now. If all we're doing is starving the resources from a resource-rich community, they're just going to move the resources somewhere else and replicate the exact same behavior. What we really need to do is to shift power. Just removing the existing manifestation of power is not going to end it. It's just going to change form. It's just going to evolve into something else. We really need to shift power at this point.
Is there anywhere that people can go to find out more about these ideas and maybe develop a plan to make these demands?
Yes, if you go to there's two sites that you can go to. One is Pan-African Community Action's website. That's pacapower.org, pacapower.org. And if you look under our position papers, you can see two position papers on community control over police, and as well as one which is the critique, the long version critique of the calls to defund the police. And you can also find out about, on the same website, about our local campaign for community control over police. And then the other one is the National Alliance Against Racial and Political Repression, and that website is NAARPR.org. And that is a national coalition of organizations who are fighting for community control over police. And you can, of course, just go to a search engine and look for community control over police.
Well, I really want to thank you for this perspective. Again, I've been speaking with Max Rameau. He is one of the founders of Take Back the Land and a part of Pan-African Community Action. Those websites, again, are pacapower.org, P-A-C-A power.org, and N-A-A-R-P-R.org, the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Thank you, Max, for joining us on KBOO today.
Thank you so much.
This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
KBOO is proud to present a two-hour Between the Covers special on Thursday, June 18th at 10 a.m. Join Between the Covers host David Naiman for a two-hour conversation with award-winning poet Nikki Finney. Finney's poems of Black perseverance engage the truth of history, the grace and necessity of memory. Her work can be found anywhere from the African American Museum of History and Culture in D.C. to Publisher Weekly's anti-racist poetry reading list. Again, that's a two-hour Between the Covers special on Thursday, June 18th at 10 a.m. here on your local community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on your listener-supported, volunteer-powered KBOO Community Radio. I'm Jenny Yokoyama, your host tonight and one of your interim station co-managers. Celeste isn't able to join me tonight. She's feeling a little bit under the weather. So, Celeste, if you're tuning in, wishing you well and a speedy recovery. All right, so getting to the news. So coming up this week on at KBOO. Oh, and if this is your first time tuning in to News from the Boo, News from the Boo is the show where we talk about everything KBOO, what's going on inside, outside, all around the KBOO community. It's a show for our volunteers. It's a show for our listeners.